You know, you start with anecdote, then you go to case, then you go to case series, and then eventually you get to data. And you should be challenging your bias all the way.
Welcome to the Journal of Special Operations Medicine. I'm your co-host, Alex
Dude Merkel.
And I'm Josh Randles. And this is where evidence-based medicine meets unconventional warfare.
The views and opinions you are about to hear are the speaker's own, and nothing contained herein is to be considered the official opinion of the Journal of Special Operations Medicine or the U.S. government, including the Defense Health Agency, Department of Defense, Department of the Army, Navy, or Air Force.
This is Dan Godbee, medical editor of the Journal of Special Operations Medicine. Thank you for joining us for the summer 2020 edition of the JSOM podcast, where we review and summarize a few select articles from our journal. Besides the article about clothing effects on limb tourniquets that Josh and Alex review, others worth a look are the one regarding testosterone by O'Hara and Ayala, and the article by Hall on ketamine. As always, our ongoing series are definitely worth checking out, and especially the TCCC article in this edition. Now, here's Josh and Alex with the podcast.
And welcome back to the summer 2020 edition of the JSOM podcast. So nice to chat with you again. Josh, anything new and exciting in your world these days?
Well, I mean, we are appropriately social distanced by the entire United States. So
West Coast to East Coast.
Yeah, we're being safe right here. Alex, I heard you were actually on the East Coast up in New York City at the Javits. You want to tell me what was going on up there?
Well, you know, I think we've probably all heard by now that we are under quarantine for plague, apparently, for the indefinite future. And, you know, there was a pretty big push for a DSCA, or defense support of civilian authorities, through the DOD. So I think they had already tapped all of the good people and they still needed some more. And so they reached into the bottom of the pile and I got asked to go help work in the Javits. So that was really fun. Had a great time with some really smart folks, and hopefully there'll be some more publications and education coming out about that, because there were some really great folks with a lot of soft background who ended up really helping with the implementation and efficacy of those efforts. Specifically, of course, as you know, Colonel Dave Hamilton, who is our Army PA consultant, was actually one of the CASH OICs, and I think his training and experience in working in improvised environments was so needed for that, and really did a great job.
However, Alex, I believe on the downside, you had to spend some time staring at a blank wall. Is that right?
Yeah, the quarantine afterwards ended up getting done at Fort Dix in New Jersey, which, surprise, that's also a hot spot. So when I returned to California, they were not too pleased that I had quarantined in a hot spot and had to do another quarantine. So I've definitely gotten some good practice with some meditation, staring at blank walls for a while, which has improved my IQ from, you know, 10 to 12 or whatever it is.
You got two whole IQ points out of that?
Essentially, but nobody really cares about us. Why don't we move on to more interesting stuff, which is smart people writing articles for the JSOM this month. So for the summer edition of the JSOM, we're actually focusing heavily on tourniquets for this edition. And we'll see that with this first manuscript that you're going to be reviewing, Josh. And for those folks who want to get a little bit more in depth with one of the authors from this article, I encourage you to listen to our standalone 20th anniversary interview series that will be coming out in June with Dr. John Craig. Josh and I spent a significant amount of time talking to him about the history of tourniquets. And as you know, Josh, that's a subject near and dear to my heart, since I actually did my PhD on civilian use of tourniquets. And there's a whole lot to it to unpack in there. So I can't recommend enough listening to that interview and understanding why most of the articles this month are related to tourniquets.
Well, with that said, let's talk about the step duration effects on blood loss and simulated designs of tourniquet use procedure by Dr. John Craig, Dr. James Aiden, Dr. Michael Dubyek at the Institute of Surgical Research at Brooke Army Medical Center, San Antonio, Texas. The researchers were looking to calculate simulated blood loss per step of tourniquet application, and then they wanted to see if changes in that order of steps would change the outcome. And so they built a mathematical model. And based on previous research, teaching, and experience, they determined there were 14 steps and sub-steps of tourniquet application by a first aid provider in a civilian environment. And once they named those steps, they assigned times to them. They then set blood loss for approximately one quarter the average blood loss from a traumatic thigh amputation, which was 2.5 milliliters per second. The amount of blood loss for the initial steps was calculated, and then they applied various multipliers to simulate a slow tourniquet application and a fast tourniquet application. And then they recalculated the amount of blood lost. Then they reordered the steps. They sometimes took away some steps that were then made unnecessary by that reordering, and they recalculated blood loss based on those multipliers. Just of note, the initial set of steps was 14, and tourniquet application was 13 of 14. But when they reordered the steps, there were only 11 steps required, and tourniquet application was step 5 of 11. So the initial set of steps resulted in a minimum of 420 milliliters of blood loss and a maximum of 2.6 liters. Now, when they altered the steps, the blood loss then was changed to a minimum of 250 mLs and a maximum of 750. They determined that patients lost approximately 92% of their blood volume before a tourniquet actually ever touched them, and that moving tourniquet application to before calling 911 showed a significant reduction in the amount of time spent bleeding. So I think the top line takeaways that earlier application of tourniquets reduced blood loss is fairly obvious, and no one argues that point. However, I think the more important takeaway is actually a little bit more subtle, in that we need to look at the steps that we are doing any procedure and looking to see if reordering or changing those steps will have increased efficiency or improved outcomes. And I also think we need to look at the way we're training those procedures to others. And I think that's where it becomes more important, is passing along better habits to the next level of trainees. That way, when they do it, they already have those improved outcomes and improved efficiency built in, as opposed to us dinosaurs who have to learn the hard way to do it better. Anyways, Alex, what do you think?
Yeah, so as you know from our meetings with Dr. Aiden, when you walked out of there, you felt like somebody had clobbered you with a sledgehammer to the head. That dude is just so smart. And so I don't disagree with any of the analysis that they did. But as you know, I do continue to take issue with the use of tourniquets for civilian use, because they end up being very limited, especially in the setting of mass shooting. And so really, I think that there certainly is a use of tourniquets in a 911 setting, which this was specifically evaluated for, but that is very limited and generally, according to my research, involve amputations, so things like MVCs and that sort of thing, and probably have very limited effect for shootings. How about you?
No, I don't disagree with you. You and I have talked plenty about this particular. I think you make a good point about that. Again, my takeaway is primarily for training purposes and looking at that. So
absolutely. In a combat setting, this data, I think, actually really drives forward how we should be setting up and establishing our T-tri-C for our combat victims.
Agreed.
This quarter, for our guest medic, we've got the privilege of Will Price. And Will, welcome so much. If I understand correctly, you are one of the lucky few who gets to work full-time at a trauma center and then deploy downrange as a role two. Is that right?
Yeah, thanks, Alex. I do. It's been a feat trying to transition over from being a resuscitation team to a full surgical team. But we're getting through it, and it's been a lot of fun so far.
Yeah, I bet. You're probably going to get a few emails from other medics out there wondering how in the world they get that. Sounds like you got the golden ticket from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Yeah, pretty much. You know, I just kind of, everything kind of aligned for me as far as PCSing, and I interviewed for this position and did our own little kind of tryout, basically, and, you know, we got over here. So.
Right on. Well, what article do you have the privilege of wading through for us this edition?
So this paper is an original research, and the title of it is Clothing Effects on Limb Tourniquet Application. This research was carried out by Dr. Piper Wall and her team at the Surgical Education Department at Unity Point Health Iowa Methodist Medical Center in Des Moines, Iowa, along with Dr. Boozing, sorry if I'm getting his name wrong, Ms. Hainton, Ms. Smith, and Dr. Reiner. Limb tourniquet placement over clothing risks missing injuries and is associated with looseness, risking ongoing bleeding and venous occlusion without arterial occlusion. To avoid these problems, tactical combat casualty care guidelines recommend limb tourniquet application on skin unless providing care under fire. Many clinical and stage pictures of tourniquets applied to every clothing exist in research literature and tourniquet training associated videos. This study purpose was to explore clothing effects on thigh tourniquet application. The hypothesis were clothing could affect the application process, pressure measurements, and tourniquet pressures. So the background of this study is sometimes tourniquets are applied over clothing. This study explored clothing effects on pressure application process. They used a CAT-7 soft T-wide, CAC-arm T, and SWAT. Were used in different clothing conditions, bare skin, scrubs, uniforms, and tights, on mid-thighs and on models, ballistic gel, and yoga mats. This was done in three phases. Phase 1 investigated clothing influences on pressure effects of controlled force application. Phase 2 investigated clothing influence on tourniquet application and secured pressures. Only non-elastic tourniquets were used in this phase. Phase 3 investigated clothing influence on the complete tourniquet application process and pressures. Occlusion was defined by loss of audible pulse by the Doppler. And that's also something to note is that a non-compliant tourniquet or an incomplete study was most likely because of patients' non-compliance with tourniquet application. So when the patients seemed to be in pain, they would stop the tourniquet application. And so that was the majority of their non-compliant or non-finished tourniquets. Incompletes were recorded, applier's inability, recipient discomfort, or others. Because appliers had melt in phase 2, appliers stood in phase 3. The results of this were clothing affected pressure responses through controlled force applications. On models, clothing affected secured pressures by altering surface interactions. On gel clothing, CAT-7 had 331 millimeters of mercury up from 247 on bare. The soft T-wide had 107 millimeters of mercury up from 99 millimeters of mercury on bare. The TAC RMT had 148 millimeters of mercury up from 101 on bare. Matt's clothing, CAT-7, had 278 millimeters of mercury up from 246 millimeters of mercury on bare. The soft T-wide had 145 millimeters of mercury up from 121 millimeters of mercury on bare. The TAC RMT had 138 millimeters of mercury up from 99 millimeters of mercury on bare. Conclusion. Clothing was not necessarily affecting tourniquet pressures. Surface-to-tourniquet interactions affected the ease of strap sliding, so concerns should still exist on whether application over clothing will dislodge in the distal direction more easily than applied on skin. The pros that I see is one of the biggest ones is the thoroughness of this study. It is too easy to ignore research on tourniquets because of how simple and effective they are, but we only get better in understanding medicine and growing as a community if people put in the effort to publish papers like this that reaffirm common practice and give detailed reasons why. I love all the graphs in this. Being a medic, we aren't very knowledgeable on reading these types of studies, and that's just from my personal opinion. So having graphs that accurately describe the pressure results and all of the different conclusions that they came up with in this paper is very beneficial for me personally, because I can take that graph and I can go explain to other people and effectively communicate the things that I'm seeing. Some of the cons I see, or the one con that I see, I felt as if this could have been taking a step further. Although there's a ton of information that I can be talking about fully from this paper, the volume of tests that run were extremely high, I still feel as if more could have been done to show this in the real-world application of tourniquets. The data could have been very easily correlated with things that EMS providers are seeing on the streets. And I think that's an important thing to understand when we're talking about static studies, is how does this apply to the streets in real-world medicine. So I would say that's my one way forward with this. I would say if you could take this data and show how it correlates to the real world and apply it to EMS providers everywhere and see if the data they're getting from real-world applications matches the conclusions that were drawn up in this study. All in all, this was a great paper to read, and I really appreciate you guys having me on and talking about it and providing my two cents. Thank you.
And now a brief message from our underwriters.
Hey, Alex, did you know you can buy things over the internet?
Well, this is a podcast, so do you mean stamps or a mattress from some weird company or a boxed prefab dinner?
Yes. Order yours today.
And for this edition, I've got the privilege of covering a manuscript from our furry neighbors to the north. Furry and friendly. also known as Canadians.
Okay.
So this list of outstanding authors, which includes both physicians as well as pre-hospital providers, was titled Temporizing Life-Threatening Abdominal Pelvic Hemorrhage Using Proprietary Devices, Manual Pressure, or Single Knee, an Integrative Review of Proximal External Aortic Compression, which they term PEAC, or even knee BOA. It's quite witty, guys. So in looking at the file on the JSOM website for author requirements and trying to identify which specific type of manuscript this is, it does not appear to be original research, but is more, even as listed in their title, a review of the literature. And they do a pretty good job through what would have had to have been a librarian-assisted review of the literature, looking for different proprietary devices from a pre-specified time span, and then doing a brief summary of those different manuscripts using either off-the-shelf technology or covering some of their own previous publications and research looking at the use of abdominal compression with either your hands or your knee for rescuers. And this specifically highlights some of the previous research that this group had done, both in a benchtop setting as well as with their own feasibility study that they had accomplished with healthy volunteers in 2013, where they had some reasonable takeaway data. They end up comparing all of these, and I think did a really good job of saying that all of these techniques aren't necessarily an either or, but are a continuity of treatment. So in their conclusion, what they note is that, as with much pre-hospital resuscitation research, evidence exists for PEAC, but it is of low quality and frequently from collateral populations. Accordingly, clinical recommendations such as ours are of expert opinion only. We believe that the available indirect evidence supports the use of PEAC when faced with massive lower abdominal or pelvic hemorrhage. The available evidence and opinion supports early application of PEAC until either 1) a suitable device or hemostatic packing could be applied, or 2) an invasive procedure such as REBOA or resuscitative thoracotomy can be performed by a suitably skilled clinician and our victim is spirited to surgical rescue. God, I love the Canadians. They're great. And we've actually got the privilege of chatting with a couple of the authors here in a few minutes. But first, Josh, let's go through our 11-point quality assessment.
Let's do that, Alex. You ready?
Hit it.
Was it a clearly focused question?
It was a question. It was, what's the literature say about this topic? So, yes.
Was the author use appropriate for the question?
They did a literature review. They very obviously used a librarian, though I didn't see that cited in the literature. And I think we can all nitpick literature reviews, but in general, I think this is pretty reasonable.
So was their cohort recruited in an appropriate way?
Not applicable, unless you want to dive down into the literature reviewed, but ain't nobody got time for that.
Was the exposure accurately measured to minimize bias?
See above.
And was the outcome accurately measured to minimize bias? See above.
Ditto.
Have the authors identified all important confounding factors?
Yeah, we get into this a little bit in the interview, but I think so.
Was the following of subjects complete enough?
For this one, it's easy because the outcome is immediate mortality or demise if the procedure is not successful. So definitely.
How precise are the results and the estimate of risk?
It depends on which of the different articles you're looking at.
Do you believe the results?
Yes.
Explain your question.
We get into this more with the authors. And I think what's important is that as we talk about with the authors, we identify the correct patient population for this procedure. And we're seeing this right now in REBOA, which is actually a continuity of this same intervention, which is if we apply REBOA too broadly, we actually end up performing more risk than we do benefit. And so we need to be very, very careful when we find these new interventions and only tailor it to just the right patients and don't get the dreaded indication creep that we see in medicine.
Can the results be applied to your patient population?
Definitely. And as we got into before we actually started recording with the authors, I've actually performed this intervention in our hospital for somebody who was bleeding out, and it worked. So, yeah.
And lastly, do the results of the study fit in with other available evidence?
Well, what they get into is there's just not a lot of other literature available. So I just applaud the authors tremendously for specifically putting this into print so that we can build a more robust body of evidence for the intervention.
There is a place for expert opinion, and I think this is the place where there isn't anything before, especially for something as simple. When I was trained as a medic, they often said put the knee in the groin if there's a lower extremity hemorrhage. I never would have thought to extend it further into the abdomen. I think this is a good first look, and it's a good primer and a place for us to start and move forward.
So you're saying when somebody is going squirt, squirt with bleeding, you need to go squash, squash with your knee?
Oh God, Alex. Oh God.
And Josh, you know, to answer some of the questions that we've got about this manuscript, we've got the privilege of having not one, but two authors on the line here to go over some of the insights and things that we wanted to tease out a little bit better. So we've got Matt Duma as well as Peter Brinley of the world-renowned Brinley Sessions from MCRIT. And welcome to the show, gentlemen. Can you give us a brief intro about your clinical experience and background?
I'm a registered nurse. I started off my career in healthcare and pre-hospital care, doing some ski patrolling and some search and rescue stuff, and as a medic. And my nursing career has been in emergency and critical care, and now I've specialized in resuscitation as my academic interest.
And Peter Brinley, I'm an ICU doctor and professor of this, that, and the other up in Edmonton, Alberta, who's always been interested in resuscitation. And it started out by sort of teaching it, establishing who survived and who didn't, and then studies on how do we get better at it, everything from human factors to clever roadside ideas. That's what brings us to this particular publication.
And I think you've also got a really good penchant for giving folks a good ribbing at smack, from what I've heard.
I completely resemble that compliment.
Fantastic. Well, gentlemen, thanks again for joining us. We really enjoyed reading your manuscript because, as you mentioned before we started recording, this is a novel idea that probably deserves to get out because for the patients we're doing this on, the alternative is death. So with that said, we did have a couple of questions after reading through the manuscript. And the first one was, from reading your review, it seems that the majority of evidence for the use of this technique is focused around postpartum hemorrhage. Do you have an idea about why this might be the case?
It's a great question. I think there's far more literature in the postpartum hemorrhage because there are significantly more bleeding postpartum women than there are folks who are bleeding from junctional hemorrhage. Also, they've got a great head start on actually publishing literature from that pathology. My initial training in external aortic compression came from pre-deployment training for taking care of obstetrical hemorrhage. And I think that the other thing worth noting is that we didn't always consider that this pattern of bleeding or junctional hemorrhage was even survivable until about a decade ago. So we're really just catching up in literature now on using external aortic compression for abdominal, pelvic, or junctional hemorrhage.
Oh, fascinating. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Thanks. And I think I've heard somewhere in the literature that something like 2/3 or 3/4 of Doctors Without Borders, their surgical care is OBGYN care. So that actually makes a lot of sense. Thanks for sharing that. And so the next question we had was, did your previous feasibility study address pressure and occlusion related to abdominal girth? We wonder if applying this to a patient population other than healthy, young, military-age males might have different efficacy.
Well, I think that's my chance to jump in now. I mean, the short answer is yes. We've looked at this from every direction. We've looked at it with, you know, small responders and small victims and large responders and large victims. And so, yes, it absolutely does. I mean, a lot of good research is common sense codified. So obviously, the more you can push and the less you need to push, the more likely you are to exceed the pressure of the blood vessel that's hemorrhaging out. And so Matt can possibly talk about this more, but we also did ultrasound-based studies to see when you would get ultrasound occlusion of the blood vessel. And yeah, it's common sense codified. If you can do CPR, you can do this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's fair. Well, I'm sure you guys have had experience in the back of the box as well, but I know some of my colleagues in EMS have actually gotten up on the gurney and grabbed the handrails on the ceiling to jump on people's chests that have a excess abdominal girth.
Well, with that delightful mental image, it is worth mentioning our first case report was that Matt's first experience, he pressed on a hard surface and was able to compress the aorta to the point that the patient woke up again. Then when a smaller rescuer took over, the patient hemorrhaged out and became unconscious again. So the sort of proof of concept of a bigger rescuer, because as I've already mentioned, Matt's got a healthy appetite, shall we say. And then when he was in the back of the ambulance, the rescuer took over and they pressed over the top of a mattress and couldn't get good compression. And as best as we understand, didn't get fully on top of the patient and pressed down. And so the patient became unresponsive too. And so what we would suggest here is if you're doing this maneuver in an ambulance, get them on the heavy ground. In the same way that in CPR, you would put a backboard underneath someone. So possibly put them on the floor.
Good to know. Yeah, that sounds like you did a pre and post experiment almost on the same patient. That's great. Moving on. So in the team's research, what were the points of failure for applying this procedure with newly trained rescuers? And I guess I'd add on, it looks like you've got a couple of different ways to apply this, be it circumferentially squeezing the abdomen or two fists from the front or even a knee.
That's a great question. We've had the pleasure of teaching well over 100 clinicians the technique, and what comes up the most for us is that, especially when teaching the bimanual technique, people using both of their hands, that they don't press hard enough, they don't press for long enough. They kind of need permission to go ahead and push deep into the abdomen, through the tissues, down to compress the aorta to the vertebral column. And then the other techniques, whether you're going to be using an elbow or a knee, we find that the knee is especially effective when your patient or victim is on the ground and it can be easy to stabilize yourself. So I think really giving people permission to go ahead and push deep down into the abdomen is really the major teaching point that I have to reiterate to our students.
Fair enough. And certainly, as we talked about earlier, this intervention currently seems to be selected for patients whose alternative is death. But if we see some indication creep in the future and this ends up getting applied to patients that don't have an alternative of death, then we may see potentially the risks outweigh the benefits. So with that in mind, what risks does this procedure include? And have you seen any injuries related to the treatment? And are there any potential harms from misapplication or inappropriate application?
Well, I think you've made the point that the vast majority of people, it's this or death. And so the biggest thing is what Matt has said is that people won't do it hard enough. That's sort of the biggest risk to the patient. The risk to the rescuers, I mean, is it any different than any other type of resuscitation? You have to get close to a patient. And I suppose if the patient's wide awake and belligerent, they could sock you one. It is one of the other potential reasons why using the knee, and we never miss a good pun, so knee boa, as we're calling it, why knee boa may be beneficial, because not only are you not pushing your hands into blood, you're putting a knee in. Secondly, you actually have your hands free to help resuscitate the patient too. Matt, in your experience of teaching, any risks to rescuers or rescuees?
No, in our trial of 12 healthy yet angry volunteers that we pressed on and evaluated the technique by ultrasound, pain score is 7 out of 10, so it's certainly not comfortable. I think that a patient could potentially will you off of their abdomen. But the only source, there's indirect evidence for some injuries from the pig models of having the abdominal aortic junctional tourniquet applied to them for 2 hours. And I can't imagine a scenario where I'm maintaining proximal external aortic compression for 2 hours manually. But with the device, there's some concern about anoxic tissues from the lower extremities flooding the main circulation when the tourniquet is released. So that's potentially a concern. There's been some microscopic damage to the gut potentially from these sorts of interventions. But, you know, we're not messing around. We really believe this is an indication for people who are truly have life-threatening injuries.
So it sounds like potentially just the reperfusion injury that we already know about from extremity tourniquets might be similar for a junctional tourniquet then.
Correct.
Yeah, fair enough. And just out of my curiosity, what is it that got you authors interested in it, and also what brought the three of you brains together?
In terms of what got us interested in this project, and this project is the paper you have in front of you is the culmination of five or six other papers, is, as much as it pains me to say, Matt Doomer's very clever, creative brain that needed an outlet. And so I'm an ICU doctor. Matt is all sorts of remarkable things in his past life, everything from a ski patrol to a paramedic to a nurse to a resuscitationist, his word, not mine. And I heard about this very clever intervention that he did on a patient. Somebody had been shot and was exsanguinating out on the roadside. And I think chance favors a prepared mind. With all of Matt's background training, with working overseas, working in the developing world, of seeing postpartum hemorrhages, and just having a clever brain, he responded immediately and intuitively put both of his fists above the umbilicus to tamponade the aorta, as he had heard of done in postpartum hemorrhage. And I heard this story and thought, well, this is fantastic. Not that it's genius and nobody had ever thought to do this. It's just that these sort of roadside ideas so infrequently get into the mainstream literature. And in fact, the challenge is often not could you do it, but it's would you think in the heat of battle, literal or figurative battle, would you think to do this? And Matt did. And as a bedside pampered clinical doctor, I wanted to see this in the literature so that we thought to do the same thing when a patient came busting through the doors of the emergency room or hemorrhaged out in our ICU while we were trying to rush them to the OR. So that's the sort of story. But the bigger part, or perhaps a more interesting thing, if indeed there is an audience listening in, who knows, is, you know, I've done traditional academic work and we bemoan the fact that it often isn't practical, it often isn't shared. And there's almost sort of two tribes. There's the tribe that do the clinical work and have these clever resuscitation hacks, for want of a better word, but they don't get communicated into the literature and they don't necessarily read the literature produced by pompous asses such as myself. So to me, this was a brilliant project to take a guy like Matt who had fantastic ideas but hadn't yet learnt the dark arts of publishing and sort of take him through the mentoring process, but equally meet in the middle where my work got more practical and Matt's work got more seen. Does that sound fair, Matt?
Sure does, yeah.
And then to wrap this up, in your conclusion, you note that the recommendations are expert opinion, which we know is level 3 evidence. Would you like to see further data from prospective or retrospective clinical studies prior to recommending this clinical intervention's wide adoption?
Well, I'll jump in at this point. I mean, of course, the more data, the better. You know, you start with anecdote, then you go to case, then you go to case series, and then eventually you get to data. And you should be challenging your bias all the way. And so the bias is either going to be, I don't fancy doing this, therefore it won't work, or this will be fine, don't show me the evidence. And so, yes, the more data, the more this is challenged. And you know what? If this is ultimately debunked, I'll be delighted that I played my part in science, in other words, examining and challenging hypotheses. One of the things I would point out, I worried when we wrote these papers that it would be seen as a either do the manual or genicular, i.e. knee compression, or put on one of these proprietal compression devices. And it categorically isn't either or. Our conclusion is that it is manual or knee compression until you can get the proprietal device on. The problem is the proprietal devices aren't going to be in the middle of nowhere where these accidents occur. They're not going to be in every ambulance, and they are a little bit finicky to get on, whereas jamming your knee in is pretty intuitive and pretty easy while you're getting set up to put something on that'll keep the patient safer while they're transported.
That's a good point. So really what you guys are saying is that this isn't perhaps a new intervention in and of itself as a standalone, but perhaps a bridge to a patient who's already defined as needing a junctional tourniquet.
And subsequently, they need surgical repair. You know, this is not an end treatment. This is a keep them alive till you can get them to a surgeon, or I suppose an interventional radiologist.
If only we had some of those downrange, yeah, a temporizing life-saving intervention.
Matt, anything to add?
No, that takes care of it.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for your time and insight. Really appreciate your submission. Great manuscript and great ideas from the pre-hospital field. And as always, we like to encourage those folks who are out in the side of a dirty roadside or a battlefield who have these great ideas to please share them with the community. Gentlemen, thanks so much for your time.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So that's going to be it for the summer edition of the JSON podcast. Hey, Alex, you've got a ton of experience staring at blank walls during a pandemic. Do you have any suggestions on what we should do?
Well, besides sitting in my underwear on the futon and watching reruns of Friends, I actually found it's also a great opportunity to read journal articles. How about you?
So... Well, frankly, Alex, when I'm sitting in my underwear on my futon, I prefer to watch Scrubs, but that's a personal choice. You do whatever you like. However, if you like reading journal articles, here at the JSON Podcast, we love to have guest medic article reviewers. And if you read something and you think you've got something to say, email us at podcast@jsononline.org. Also, if you don't feel like being on the podcast, but you do have some articles that you think are really interesting, articles that have changed your practice, you know what? We would love for you to post those articles to our social media sites, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and then a short blurb on why that changed your practice and why it's important that we see that. While you're out there, stay healthy, stay safe, and we'll see you next time.
This is Sophia Rodriguez, Director of Marketing and Social Media Communications for the JSON. I want to encourage our listeners to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn at JSON Online, and to sign up to receive our free e-newsletter on our website at jsononline.org. We love hearing from our subscribers and followers and welcome your feedback and suggestions.
This is Colonel Shackelford from the Joint Trauma System reminding you to submit your DD-1380 and TC-3 AAR to JTS after the mission.